Hello and welcome to another episode of the Motown Megacast. I am one of your three hosts, Alex. With me, I've got Ryan and Paul. And I'll be honest, Paul and I just had a pretty heated debate before the podcast. We are talking about, we won't get into it again because we'll just yell at each other like we just did. We'll get very angry. But essentially, it boils down to Paul doesn't like the NHL playoffs. And I'm just going to put it at that. I think we'll keep it there. It's been a while since we've recorded, so we have all sorts of things to get into right now. Let's start with Pistons. You want to go ahead with Pistons?
Yeah, so the biggest kind of storyline right now is just draft lottery being 2 weeks away. You know, just kind of hoping that we can get some of that Red Wings luck. If we could stay where we are, that would be lovely.
The first time in the lottery history that the Red Wings have stayed put.
Maybe the Pistons can pull off another first and move up, because that would be the first time.
What is the statistical likelihood of those right now?
So their chance of a first overall pick is, I think it's 14.8%. And then second, third, fourth are all like 12, 11, something like that. And then fifth and sixth are higher. Fifth is like 20%. Sixth is like 28%.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, I don't know, just from the surface, it is kind of scary to see that, like, our highest odds, or we are most likely to get the sixth overall pick.
That's
just by the numbers. But
that's terrifying.
But then, you know, you have to look at it. Like, it's still at, like, a 28% chance or whatever. Like, you know, you still have that 78% chance that you're higher than that.
Yeah, but if you do the numbers, the odds that they get a fifth or sixth round pick is 48% chance, which is kind of ridiculous that they almost have a 50-50 shot to move down in the lottery. That is a very flawed thing. I didn't even realize it was that ridiculous. And they only have about a 40% chance to move up. You should have a higher chance, or the same amount of chance of moving up and down, especially that high up in the draft. But
yeah, and you know, if we're talking numbers, like, what are the odds the Pistons move down again? Like, they're just, you know, when you can freak yourself out with statistics, but I don't know.
Oh, we know they're going to move down. We know they're going to move down to six. Because that's just the Pistons' luck. That's Detroit's luck.
I choose to be the voice of optimism. I think this year might be different.
You know, just because the Red Wings stayed put, I'll go with Paul. Or I'll go with Ryan here. I'll just say they move forward, just because I don't want to be
and
a downer.
If they move up at all, then that, you know, you're at number one overall, because they're currently sitting at the second. So a move up would mean Cade Cunningham.
God. And we were just talking about this too before, how important this Pistons draft is to, like, the organization as a whole, and how quickly, like, I compared it to next year's Red Wings draft, where, like, a home run in this draft, if you get that chance to get that generational player on top, it changes the trajectory of the franchise at this point.
And I think we're seeing more and more, especially with these NBA playoffs going on, how impactful a young lead guard can be.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you know, your Lucas and your Trae Youngs of the world, and
I love
Devin
Young.
Booker.
I love Trae
Donovan Young. Mitchell, guys like that, who are just, you know, like, ushering in a new era of just dominance in the NBA. And even guys like Ja Morant, I know he's the eighth seed, but it seems clear that he has a pretty bright, like, playoff future, I would say.
Yeah, and what people and the fans need to understand is that just because you get a Zion Williamson or a Ball or a Ja Morant, your franchise will get into playoff contention very quickly. But that's what we've seen. We've only seen playoff contention. It's going to take several years, like with a Trae Young and the Hawks, to actually be competitive. So just because the Pistons get Cade Cunningham doesn't mean that they're going to be competitive right away. They'll probably be a French playoff team, but it's probably going to take 4 or 5 years for them to actually be a team that can win a playoff round, assuming they don't make any big moves or big signings.
Well, so the thing with that is,
not a playoff round. I I think 4 or 5 years to be a championship contender, but you can certainly, I think you could vie for a 8-7 seed, or 8-7 maybe. I mean, I don't want to say 6 seed, but I think you can very well win. I think you can very well win a few playoff games within 5 years. Like, I agree that they're not title contenders right away. But, I mean, in the end, I guess we're just arguing over, you know, we're nitpicking each other's arguments. Because at the end of the day, I think we both agree that they will move forward. like it will advance significantly further with a Cade Cunningham versus like a, another top end player. Like I think you're completely right here, Ryan.
That, yeah, and to Paul's point about like Trae Young being a few years away, if you're looking at it strictly like just Trae Young's development is alone gonna determine the success of the Hawks, then I think you're kind of looking at it wrong. Like you have to also consider like roster construction around Trae Young and just the competence of the front office to be able to like,
and we've already seen
to put this out a more polished product.
And this is a competent GM.
Yeah, I definitely think the Hawks have a bright future. And I'm really excited to see all these young guys kind of, you know, just like we were talking about, ushering in a new era of just dominance in the NBA, you know, the new superstars.
And I just know that Detroit fans would fall in love with these Pistons. Like, if the Pistons, like, grew up together as a team and became, like, I don't know, the next, like, Detroit team. Because the last time we had a Detroit team, I mean, what, 2012, the Tigers? The Tigers in 2012 was, like, the
last. I guess, are you talking about, like, a contender?
Yeah, just, okay. Like, a contender.
Because I was going to say we had the 2014 guys. Lions.
No, I don't think they're the same. Because, like, when I think of, like, what I mean by that is, like, guys that your grandpa, or, like, I guess it would be us at this point, like, or has weird autographs of. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like my dad has a lot of autographs from the 80s Tigers. Like, that's a group of Detroit boys to me.
Yeah.
Like, the bad boys, the Pistons, mm-hmm. the Red Wings with, you know, with Datsyuk and Zetterberg. That was, like, an identity.
Right.
And, like, it's going to be so fun to have, like, a Detroit team with an identity. And that's what it seems like the Pistons are building right now, is you can already feel their identity. It's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know sometimes I'm kind of overly optimistic maybe, but it really kind of does feel like we're seeing the same thing with the Lions. And that's hard to say because they haven't even played a single game with their front office. But it does seem like they're kind of instituting, I mean, this is an overused term, but just a culture a little bit there.
I mean, I agree.
It seems like, and I'm sure it's way too early to say this, but I don't know, some of the energy kind of coming out of like some of these media sources.
Yeah.
And, I don't know.
And it's, culture-wise, I think you're right. I think they're moving for sure in the right direction. But in terms of like roster, like growth or like how a roster is formulated, I'm not sure there's a team as like prepared for the future as the Pistons.
Yeah, I think as definitely
ready.
Right, the Pistons have kind of their building blocks right now, and now they're kind of just
which is not trying like to fill a position out that really a lot of teams get in.
The Pistons, God knows the last time the Pistons were like this optimistic. Honestly,
yeah, no,
with their roster construction, I mean. Yeah. For a second, it seemed like Andre Drummond was gonna be like a perennial all-star, but
yeah. And the big difference between the Lions and Pistons right now is that the Pistons like their coaching staff. The Lions just got off of a fringe coaching staff of the Quinn Trisha era. Pistons have Dwayne Casey. He's doing a fine job. He did a very good job in Toronto for what it was. I know they fired him and then they won the championship, so that's weird, but that happens in the NBA. But
they also fired him, like, wasn't it like right after he won Coach of the Year?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't
I remember how shocked I was when that happened. I was like, what?
Yeah, getting the one seed and then firing the dude. I don't know. But the Pistons seem to like him. I really like Dwayne Casey. But the Lions are moving away, and they're just starting out. So we don't even know what's going on with that.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Is where, like, we've already seen we've already seen the culture successfully instilled with the Pistons. And I think that's the difference. Because I do like the grumblings of the culture, you're right. And as much as I honestly, like, I love Dan Campbell as a guy. I love watching his interviews. I don't think he's a good head coach. I know I'm going to get burnt alive because a lot of Detroit fans are very hardcore about supporting their coaches. And I love that. I love that. Like, even to a fault sometimes. Like, a lot of people you saw clinging on to Matt Patricia. But, like, I love that this town is passionate about their coaches because that's not something that happens often in the sports cities. A lot of times you see, like, Philly. Can you imagine how quickly they turn on Patricia in Philly? Like, within seconds. And so I love that about Detroit, but also I just don't think he's a good, I think it's a weird hire. And it reminds me of like Quinn Trisha, where you tried to go the pendulum swung a little too far towards analytics, because that's where they struggled before. Or not analytics, but the smartest guy in the room type vibe. And now it feels like it's swinging the other way. But so far, I like what I've seen. I like the culture. It's saying all of that. I want to make the point, not that I don't like Dan Campbell, but I'm pleasantly surprised that the culture seems to be effectively being fostered right now. At least just in player interviews, they just seem like they're having more fun. Like, it's tangibly more fun. And obviously, it's easier to tell. That's like going from North Korea to America with freedom. Like, it's pretty easy to be happier in America. But I want to see it successfully instilled first, I guess. That's my only worry.
Yeah, I think you made some good points. And I wanted to apologize because we kind of hijacked the Red Wings talk a little bit. But...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's similar. Hockey's a bit harder to get a culture on because, honestly, hockey players are not as fun as NBA players. Like, yeah. NBA players, like, and NFL players, like, they're pretty talkative with the media. They all have distinct personalities, whereas, like, hockey guy's just kind of hockey guy. So it's a bit harder to read the philosophy, but there is definitely, like, there is an Yzerman-type player. And I think the number one, so a couple of adjectives to kind of, hockey fans are not going to like the first one. It's the two-way player. It's such like an overwrought theme. It's basically obviously good at defense, good at offense. And, you know, most famously, it's Yzerman who did that. He was an offensive player, and then he got coached how to be a two-way player. But I do think two-way player is something that Yzerman looks for a lot. And you saw with Dylan Larkin, he developed as a two-way player this year. He had a bit of a weak season, and then, more importantly, Filip Zadina. Filip Zadina actually regressed significantly this year in terms of statistics. Part of that is due to the fact that his shooting percentage this year was 7.5% instead of 13%. But like you saw Zadina learn how to be a two-way player. And then I think more importantly is that he, like it sounds basic again, but he wants players who want to be there. That's why Mantha got kicked out. I mean, Mantha... great guy, love him, fun player. He just didn't seem like he wanted to be there. He didn't fit Yzerman's plan. So it's harder to get a read on a culture, but I think looking at the moves, Yzerman's also developing a culture very well. So I think most Detroit, except for the Tigers, are developing good cultures. And I would even argue that they have some good aspects of the culture.
Yeah, I don't know. I always kind of go back to like Alavila and his effect on kind of the culture that's being set there. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I think Alavila's effect on the, yeah, I don't know. Just his reach, because if I look at just the coaching staff, I actually think that's a pretty, you know, there. I think there is, yeah, something to be said about the team having chemistry at points and looking like they have fun. And yeah. Chris Fetter as a pitching
coach.
Yeah,
like Hinch and Fetter. It seems like these guys are, you know, some coaches that you could really kind of ride to.
Who have a history of success.
Yeah, too. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And like, if they...
Fetter developed some great prospects over in Ann Arbor, and AJ Hinch is a world champion.
And it already seems like, you know... we've seen the Fetter effect on like Mize and even Scooble lately.
I think one of the big issues of the Tigers is that they're in between two regimes. They have this new AJ Hinch at manager, but they still have Alavila and like the Miggies of the world in their franchise too. And they're too caught up in the past. And so is Ilitch. I don't know why Ilitch just can't get rid of Avila. And like I said last week, if they somehow got over 70 wins and they did very good at the trade deadline, I'd be all for keeping Avila. But I don't think that's going to happen. It doesn't look like it's going to happen. But once again, I would be for it if they could prove me wrong.
I think that was actually a really good point about how they're kind of in between two
one
regimes,
foot in the door,
kinda
one
like,
foot out. That's what, yeah, it feels like.
Because, I mean, we've seen... like Pistons teams try to do that where they'll hire a new head coach, yeah, and they'll just kind of try to like retool the team enough to like be competitive,
kind of do something, be competitive,
but without ripping it down to the foundations. And I think that's really like, that's just kind of the best way to go about
if you're going to do a rebuild. I think actually Paul made a really good point there, because I think with the Tigers, I think that's part of the problem is like we were told. Like, the Tiger organization told us in 2016 that this was a rebuild. And we've never gotten proof of it. You traded away our star players for a couple of guys, but I mean, for the most part, like, not much has been developed in terms of like changing culture. Like Paul mentioned, Al Avila's still there. We do have new coaching staff and all of that, like a lot of new coaching general managers, but it's almost one foot in the door and 1 foot out.
The big way I can tell that the Tigers regime is still stuck in the past and not all in on this rebuild is because they still have Miggy on the team. They have a guy hitting under 200 that is getting paid $30 million a year. And if he didn't sell tickets, really what's disappointing is that Illich and Avila keep him there to make money for the team. They don't keep him there for actual purpose because he's barely good enough to be in the lineup right now. He's kind of barely been good enough to be in the lineup for the last few years. They should have traded him when they had the chance. They should consider releasing him. And Illich should also fire Avila at the end of the season to finally get rid of this old regime that isn't working. It's a 5-year rebuild, and it's barely off the ground.
Okay, my pushback with the Cabrera stuff is I do think that just kind of out of respect for the guy he's just done so much for the organization. I think, like, just out of respect for him, they're going to let him finish up on his own terms.
Yeah, like, I would agree there. Like, I get what you're saying, and it's logical to a point. Like, Cabrera is not pulling his weight this season, and maybe a buyout is in order. I could see that, you know, that might step on people's toes, and I think you're right that making money is a big part of it, because that's Cabrera doesn't make baseball games anymore. He makes money, essentially. But I don't want to see a cut, or I don't want to see a reassignment. I think that's a bit much. I think a good example to kind of look towards for a split that worked well was JJ Watt with the Texans. Obviously the situation was pretty, I don't know, rancid, just terrible in Houston. But I think the organization did it in a classy, like, logical way. Like, instead of trying to trade him for scraps, trade him for something like that, they just cut him, and it was a mutual thing. And I think that's the one thing I would say with Cabrera is if it's mutual and he wants a change of scenery, then I do it. But I don't think I agree with just, and I know what you're going to say, like, logically, better product on the field without Cabrera. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like, without a salary cap, it's not as important that he's making that much money.
Well, and how many times have we seen the Lions just destroy their relationships with their, you know, their franchise players? How much trouble that has caused for the organization, like how bad it's looked. Like, the last thing we would want is another situation like a Calvin Johnson situation, you know?
Yeah, the thing a little different between like J.J. Watt or Calvin Johnson is that Miggy doesn't really have anything left in the tank. It's all used up at this point. And it's really, unless we see a dramatic change within the next couple months, it's time for him to retire. It's time for the Tigers to let him go. It can only go on for so long. I don't think they should just allow this to happen. He shouldn't just be in the lineup because he is Miggy.
I think you're underselling his performance a little bit. Like, he hasn't been good, but there are plenty other guys in the league that hit near his level. And I mean, he's had cold streaks, but he's also had some hot streaks where he's been, like, you know, an impact player in select games.
He does bat 189.
I understand that, but, you know,
that's unreasonably terrible. Like, that's,
I just don't think he's necessary. I just don't think he's necessarily like a just unusable asset to the team.
He's not unusable. He's good in like a pitch hitting scenario, and he can play good at first base. I won't deny that his glove is still good. That's one thing I will always back him up on. He should be playing first. If he's playing in a game, he should not be DHing.
But. Yeah. I don't know. I guess.
All right, so that kind of got away from Pistons talk a bit there, but I think it fostered really good conversation, and I think that's what matters there, because, you know, Paul and I aren't necessarily aficionados with the Pistons. But is there anything else you want to focus on with the Pistons?
So we haven't talked about the Beilein hire yet, right?
We have not. No.
All right, so let's bring that up really quickly, because I don't think it's necessarily like huge news. Like, besides the fact that it's a recognizable name, like, it's not going to be or at least I don't think it'll be an especially impactful move. But, you know, we might as well. There's Pistons news is kind of slow right now. But yeah, so the Pistons hired John Beilein as a senior advisor for player development. So the understanding is that he's not really going to be hands-on with the players. He's kind of going to be just like a guy in the front office who's literally just an advisor, you know, like with the coaches on the roster. So I don't, like, I think they said he's not going to, like, sit with the team. He might travel with them, but he wouldn't sit, like, on the bench. So... So I guess one of the one things to talk about with this is we know that John Beilein already had a brief stint in the NBA and that did not go very well.
No.
And so, you know, it does call into question a little bit just his ability to be impactful at the NBA level. And obviously these are extremely different roles, and the magnitude of this is just so much less than when he was a head coach, obviously. But it is something to think about, you know?
Yeah, I think it's key that he's in a different section, because, like, if he was more closely associated with the players, that might foster some distrust with the players. Because, like, I don't want to write, because I think John Beilein's a great guy. All testaments of John Beilein say he's a great guy. But, like, when you're calling players, saying players are playing with thugs, and, you know, trying to change it to slugs, which is goofy. It's just kind of funny. But it's not even necessarily, like, the intent. At that point, it's just kind of, like, there is a bit of... When you think of Beilein, you think of that. You know what I mean? Like, it's not something you can avoid with Beilein now. Like, that's a part of who he is as an asset. But the thing is, I think that's probably overreading into it a bit much. He's a part of the organization, and we have a lot of Michigan fans in our fan base. I think it's fun. Like, I think it's more of an ode to the fan base than something that's actually going to change any sort of development.
And I certainly think there's something to be said about his, you know, his ability, his basketball IQ.
Oh,
and
just for sure.
His
for
knowledge
sure.
of the game and how, you know, a fresh perspective on anything could, yep. could be of use, so... I think in a role that's kind of just carries less weight, and can kind of just, like, contribute how he can, like, from a hands-off, then, you know, that's fine. And it's not like his performance is going to make or break a Pistons season, you know? He's going to just be, like, a part in the grand scheme of things, you know?
All right. Paul wants to talk.
I'm actually happy that the Pistons picked up Beilein. You know, I've always been a very big Beilein supporter, big Beilein fan. He did very well at Michigan. Probably Michigan's best head coach in the football or basketball arena within the last, say, 25 years. I think that's fairly fair. You might be able to argue Lloyd Carr person. Really, nobody else comes to mind. And players loved him at Michigan. They absolutely adored Beilein. He was very good with the players, very good recruiter. I hear only good things about Beilein. I don't think the NBA players respect him as much, but he is an advisor to the people talking to the players, which I think is a much better role for Beilein. I think that's where he'll be very successful. I'm just happy his name is with the Pistons.
Yeah, and exactly. And that's what I was talking about earlier. Like, when I was talking about like, kind of the stuff that follows Beilein, it's not that I think he's a bad guy or, like, has some sort of, like, inherent racism or something like that. I think he just said something stupid. And I think that it's hard to regain NBA players' trust in that when it's that kind of misstep. Like, that's a kind of a different misstep than just, you know, accidentally doing something to piss a player off. Something, especially in this day and age, like, it's a bit sensitive. You know, that's a sensitive topic. And now, like you said, Paul, I think it's, you know, it's about respect with NBA players. But I think he'll be fine in the role. Like I said, I think that's a bit overdramatic on my part. He's going to be good in the role. I like him as a person. I think he's a great guy. And like you said, Paul, he has not had complaints about his college players. Like, his college players love him. They all love him so much. There's a reason they came to Michigan and played hard for him. Like, he is a likable guy, and he just made some mistakes. But, Paul, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Tigers, actually? Let's transition to Tigers. We got some good talk out of Pistons. I want to hear your thoughts on one of the better months they've had in a while.
Yeah, Tigers have done better as of late. I mean, they started the season 6-6. And then they went on this tear, and not a good one. They fell all the way to like 9-22 or 9-24, something absurd. But they've climbed back from that. They've had a winning record since that. They're only 11 games under 500 now. They're 24-35 and 12 games out of first place in the division. That's not great numbers, but they are playing over 500 ball since being disastrous, so there's something to be said for that. Their hitting is still awful. Their best hitter is at 268 with Candelario, I believe. That's not a bad average in itself. But when most of your players aren't anywhere near 268, you want a couple of players at 300, not 268. He's playing well. Scope's playing pretty well. Badu started the season well, went down to almost 200, but he's back up to 240 now, so he's doing pretty well. Eric Haas, the hot shot catcher, has been hitting very well for the Tigers, has a lot of power to him. So if you're going to be hitting 250, at least be hitting some home runs. The Tigers catchers, him and Griner, can hit for catchers. None of the Tigers players are hitting amazing. None of them. They're all hitting below 300, so none of them are hitting amazing. But their catchers are some of the highlights, Haas and Griner. They have power. They have the average compared to the rest of the team. And then if you look over to the pitching side, the bullpen is this kind of a weird scenario. Greg Soto, I know, gets some hate from Tigers fans, but he's actually done a very good job so far. His ERA is almost under 3. And he has a few saves. He's decent in the clutch. He has a couple blown saves, but who doesn't? Fulmer is just, he does Fulmer things. He can be amazing, but he's not that great at the moment. And then you look over to the starters. Spencer Turnbull actually has a below 3 ERA right now and leads the teams with wins. I don't think anybody expected this. I know he had that no-hitter, but a pitcher can have a one-off no-hitter. But this is just consistent at this point. It's under 3 ERA, and he leads the teams with wins. I don't think anybody saw this coming into June. And then Casey Mize is still got a below 3.5 ERA. I think the one that is kind of disappointing right now is Matthew Boyd. His ERA is close to 4 at this point. He's not pitching bad, okay? I don't want to say that he's pitching bad. He's pitching better than the rest of the team on average. He's still a good prospect at the trade deadline, which is coming up at the end of July. And then there's the waiver deadline at the end of August, which is confusing, and I don't understand it. I don't think anybody understands it, including the owners and GMs. But we'll see what happens with the Tigers. They're just such a 500 team, but their record is so below 500 that it's just going to be so hard for them to catch up, especially if their statistics being as bad as they are.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the one and only storyline you can pull out of this last couple of weeks is the pitching, how solid the pitching is right now. Like you said, Spencer Turnbull, like, since that no-hitter and even a little before, has just been great. He's been really good. Casey Mize, like, he's still a little inconsistent.
Yeah, but how fun has he been?
But he's been great.
When he's been on,
when,
like,
he's dealing, he's
that's definitely
dealing.
I think you know, it's just so very exciting, you know.
Yeah. Yep. Just kind That's of finally seeing, what we're starting
yeah,
to
Yeah, we're seeing some of this, you know, this untapped potential that he was drafted for come to fruition a little bit, you know. We're seeing what he could look like as an ace potentially in the future.
And do you know Tariq Skubal's ERA off the top of your head, Paul? What it's around?
All I know is that it's over 3. I'm fairly certain that it's higher than Mize's.
I have it up right now. It's 4.3. Wow. I know that's not great, but after the terrible start to the season he had, like, pretty god-awful, this is quite the turnaround lately.
No, that's around team average. And if he can continue to get that lower, you want to see that below 4. I don't like seeing ERAs below 4, and I don't like to see batting averages below 250. So that's my – or I don't like ERAs above 4 and batting averages below 250. Unfortunately, the Tigers seem to be all around that except for a couple starters like Scope and Candelario and then, like, Mize, Boyd, and Turnbull.
Yeah, well, with Skubal, I'm not saying his average ERA is good. I'm saying his rebound the past couple of weeks has been good. He's been a lot more solid lately.
And he's had, like, what, like 30-something strikeouts in the past 4 games or something crazy. Like, last game he had 11. He's a strikeout
machine when he's on.
Maybe not 40, but it was – or – I don't remember exactly the number, but – I know he's had outings of, like, 11 strikeouts. I think he had 2 of them where he had, like, 7. And he's just been kind of, like, going at batters and really, like, attacking on the bump. And, you know, that's been kind of cool to see. That's similar to Casey Mize where, like, if this is a sign of things to come, then, you know, pretty exciting for sure.
Yeah, I did go on a Tigers band, or like, a while ago, and I still, for the most part, agree. Like, I'm very, very hesitant about getting any sort of excitement in me for this. But, I mean, they've looked good lately. Like, I can't just say that they haven't looked good, because they have. I think they're finally... What we were waiting to see at the beginning of this year was just some sort of semblance that this rebuild is in the right direction. And for the first couple of months, we just couldn't. There was just none. There was no indication that the rebuild was going anywhere, but now we're starting to see it. We only had Akil Badu. Yeah, literally, we clung on to Akil Badu for dear life, and, you know, which is fair.
But considering where they are now compared to earlier in the season, through, like, 32 or 35 games, this team was literally on pace to be a 120-plus loss team. Like, they were on pace to be so incredibly bad that Alavila would have been fired by now. He would have been fired by now. It would have been ridiculous. AJ Hinch would have probably been fired if they did that bad. I would have fired him if they got 125 losses. You shouldn't lose that many games of any MLB roster. I don't care if they're the Toledo Mudhens.
Good Lord, Paul. Always with the fiery hot takes. Anything else we want to talk about Tigers right now? Because I feel like the highlights are pitching, right? I mean, that's, like, consistently been.
Nothing that I can think of.
Yeah, it's been kind of slow. We're kind of in the crawl of the MLB season right now. It's getting where, I don't know, we're kind of stalling out a bit. Let's look towards another Tiger or another Detroit team that's a little more boring right now, probably, but still our favorite, so we still have bias. Detroit Lions. You want to talk to us about, like, training camp and all that rookie training crap?
Yeah, so right now we're in the midst of OTAs, which is just the optional team activities there, and very soon we're going to come up on some of the mandatory programs that the teams have, but yeah, there's not a whole lot to talk about for OTAs for, you know, just us who don't have any, like, you know, media. It's just, you can read what people are saying about in the limited media access they get. But that's, you know, that's about all you can do. But it's been interesting I've seen a lot that during their like 7-on-7s, everybody's been saying Jared Goff's been looking very sharp, you know, hitting his reads, good accuracy. And, you know, how many times did we hear that about Matthew Stafford? And then how many times did he go out and just, you know, put together some amazing performances? And now, obviously, Jared Goff is no Matt Stafford, but it's pretty encouraging to hear some of the same things we've been hearing.
Yeah, I haven't seen too much out of the camp, but I have. I mean, obviously, reporters or beat writers aren't going to, you know, hone in on too much negative, but I haven't heard much negative. But, you know, there's not like a player you see who you had higher expectations of just struggling. Like, I haven't really seen any of reports like that yet.
Little off topic, but prediction: Jared Goff is going to average just over 20 fantasy points this season at quarterback for the Lions. He is going to put up a lot of passing touchdowns. I think that's where you're going to see a majority of the Lions' touchdowns, through the air. He's going to put up a lot of yards. It's going to be very fun to watch Jared Goff, even if they go 3-14.
What round would you draft him in, Paul, for fantasy?
Considering there are 16 rounds in the fantasy, if I'm getting a quarterback like Jared Goff, I probably wouldn't consider drafting him until the 12th or 13th round. I might even be able to wait until the very last round, just because he's not considered to be a top 10 or top 12 quarterback, so he'd definitely be a second string quarterback in the fantasy realm. Even if I did consider him a top 10 or top 12 quarterback, I'm not going to reach for him because there's absolutely no reason to. I can just draft like Kyler Murray, or not Kyler Murray, he's a little too good, but like a Ryan Tannehill or somebody, or a Ryan Fitzpatrick. I'd love to draft Ryan Fitzpatrick.
Ryan Tannehill's a terrible choice, Paul. How do you, how are you good
at... Hey, he gets to throw to Julio Jones now.
Oh, that's true. That's pretty sick. I don't love the Titans, but that's pretty sick. Paul's so confused right now. Julio Jones is getting traded to the Titans for a second round pick is the rumor right now.
No, that was confirmed. It was a second and I'm going to get this wrong. I think it might have been a second and a sixth for Julio and a fourth or
which
something.
Which sounds like a little, you know, in a vacuum just for one of the better wide receivers of like this generation. But also, his contract's insane. Like, I think that's why he couldn't fetch that first market price that teams are always looking for. His contract's just insane right now.
Especially in a season where all the teams are so strapped for cap space. Like, there's just, on a lot of teams, there's just not a lot of room to make something like that work.
So they have a pretty good receiving core in Tennessee all of a sudden.
On top of Derrick Henry?
Yeah, Derrick Henry. Ryan Tannehill's not a bad quarterback. He's not a bad quarterback. And then, oh, who's that other guy? He starts up an A, right?
A.J. Brown?
Yeah, A.J. Brown. Yeah. So they have A.J. Brown, very good wide receiver, very good talent, really went off last season. Then you put in Julio Jones with that. It's a very competitive team in that AFC South. And let's face it, that's not a very competitive division. Tennessee should be able to run through that division.
Who's in the AFC South?
Tennessee, Houston, Indianapolis, and Jacksonville.
Oh, yeah.
Indianapolis, yeah, I think, and Jacksonville will be their biggest competitors, and I don't even know if either of them will beat them. Houston should go 0-2 and lose both games by over 17 points.
Yeah, the Titans are going to be a team to watch this year. I think, like, I like the Jacksonville Jaguars as much as the next guy, Paul, but they're not going to be at the same level as the Colts, and their roster's just not built like the Colts, and who were we just talking about? The Titans this year.
Yeah. It's just not going to happen. I mean, it'll be interesting to watch, see how Carson Wentz does with the Colts.
That's because, so awesome, dude.
Like, who knows? I'm so interested to see how
this is going to go. And Carson Wentz is 2 years off of, like, MVP-level seasons. Like, he's had ridiculous seasons, and Philly just kind of sucks, and they got sour. That organization soured so quickly.
Yeah, and his coach, like, him and his coach, just their relationship just... crumbled, kind of. Like, they weren't talking to each other.
No. And that, you know, I don't care who you are as a quarterback. Like, you look at New England. It's soured in New England with the best coach and best quarterback of all time. Because if they don't get along, that's just not how it goes. So, I'm really excited to see. I really like this Colts team too. They're a sneaky favorite to make it to the Super Bowl for me. I think they're a dark horse team. I love the way their roster is built. They've got a solid offensive line. They've got a decent defensive line with a mean backfield. I like the Colts. And if Jonathan Taylor pops off this year, you know,
they got Quiddy Pay too.
Dude, I actually I like that team a lot actually. I mean, I do think Titans are going to be a hard out. I mean, with that offensive line, with that offense in general now, like if they had a better quarterback, I don't care what kind of season Ryan Tannehill has. He is not a top 10 quarterback.
I mean, I would put Tannehill in top 15 quarterbacks. Like, he's not bad. He's actually pretty good. You know, he's good for what he is. He's not.
I think he does what he needs to for that offense.
Okay, he's better than Baker Mayfield. It's because I hate Baker Mayfield with the most fiery passion in the world. I think Baker Mayfield is not a top 20 NFL quarterback. I can name you 20 quarterbacks right now that are better than him.
Ooh, God, you sounded like an Ohio State fan there for a second after you planted that flag. That was kind of scary, but I didn't know you had that strong feelings. But I think Paul's just letting his biased hatred of the Browns get in his eyes because he's a Steelers fan, so he's not the biggest Browns guy in the world. But I guess that's a Paul really wants to talk about this, but it's a little off topic.
I would like to mention that just because I don't think Baker Mayfield's good, I still believe that the Cleveland Browns are going to win the Super Bowl this year. So it's not really an anti-Browns bias. I just think Baker Mayfield's garbage.
I think he's pretty similar to Ryan Tannehill. I think it's arguing little bits and pieces if you're really putting... I think it's kind of silly if you're saying, like, Ryan Tannehill is, like, top 12, 13, 14. Like, he's, like, a solid quarterback, and he talks so much trash about Baker because they are the same quarterback, my friend. Like, Tannehill had a better season last year, I'd say. But, I mean, if you were like, hey, Lions, who do you want to build your organization around the next couple of years? Or who do you want someone to be a foundational... I'm not going to pick Tannehill. Tannehill just had, like, a good season. Like, he had so many chances in Miami with... I mean, obviously not great teams, but he did nothing in Miami. He comes over and has a good year with amazing receivers and all this. I think you could see the same thing from... I think Goff is, like, the best version of those type of quarterback. Of, like, that archetype where it's, like, not very good, like, talented-wise, but just does what they need to. So I guess we did link it back to the Lions. See,
he is thing the, I will say
he's the best of the of hold, the Bakers.
Hold off on your Jared Goff season predictions a little bit because we're gonna touch on that in our roundtable, which I'm very excited about.
It's a good roundtable. It's a good one. All right, let's hold off on Lions. Do you have any other Lions things?
Not really. I mean, I guess one thing that was kind of interesting I saw actually. I read that. And this seems kind of insignificant, but I read something that said Jelani Tavai has been taking, like, all of the first reps in practice. And, you know, usually that the person who does that is somebody they want to, who will, you know, do the There's drill correct. And, yeah, so, like, snaps.
Yeah.
You know, even when I played, I mean, it was high school football, but, you know, your starters would take the first reps in practice. That's just kind of, that's how it was usually structured. So...
Yeah, I think that's kind of, well. I think that is just perfectly representative of the change the regime is having type thing. Like, I think like the fact that one of like the faces of why Patricia was terrible is kind of turning around. I think that's really cool, just for the organization. It's a good look, I'd say, for the new regime.
Do you guys believe in the rumblings about Jelani Tavai that he's been looking a lot better?
I couldn't tell you a thing about that.
I knew Paul wouldn't know about that. No, I mean, I don't want to put too much stock into it. I'll see it when I believe it. I, you know, real football games are a bit different, but to me, it doesn't reflect his play as good as I think it reflects the culture.
Well, and I thought it was really interesting. I don't know if you guys saw this, but there were reports that, you know, he said he was playing at almost 270 pounds last year. Like, he was the size of a defensive end, and they were having him play off-ball linebacker. And now he's, like, down to, I think, he's almost down to 245, which is his goal weight. And so he's literally playing with, like, you know, almost 20 pounds less.
Yeah, that's a significant weight loss difference right there. And now you can actually put him at like a linebacker position and whatnot. One thing I wanted to touch on was, are the Lions going to get Todd Gurley?
So
I would love it.
It was really interesting because there were like just such heavy rumblings, like kind of like a second wave of, yeah, Todd Gurley is about to get signed. And then they announced the signing of a running back, but it was a guy from Cincinnati, I think. I think it was like Michael Warren, I believe. And everybody was just like, what? And then they just signed a linebacker today. I believe his name is Reggie Gilbert. So they have like one more spot left on their 90-man roster, I believe. So, I mean, that could be for Todd Gurley, but they also just signed another running back. So I don't know if that's just purely camp competition or if that's like, you know, a guy they see, like, maybe we can get this guy who will do something maybe similar that Todd Gurley will do for cheaper.
I mean, I would love the Lions to get Todd Gurley on their team. I don't know how much money he demands, and I know he's not nearly as great as a running back as he was 3-4 years ago when he was probably the best running back in the league for 2 years. Now he's just meh. You can start for Atlanta.
Yeah, and just, you know, injuries just took it out of the guy. Like
he was a fun running back, yeah, too. You know, he was
His knees just gave out on him, and you know, it's kind of sad a little bit. Like he's 26 years old. He's same age as Jared Goff, you know.
That's why, not to get on a rant about college football, but sometimes I hate it when they talk like I get it because running backs will always be a position. There are always going to be guys that like to play running back, but it always just sucks when, I don't know, when a player gets like kind of pushed into that being a running back. Like imagine if Lamar was genuinely pushed into being a running back. Like if he genuinely took that seriously. Like some of that is just so disheartening, and it sucks because they're the guys who get the most wear and tear on the field. Like they will just fall apart, and so it sucks when you see a young, talented guy come in and just do that. But I think that also speaks to the fact that what we talked about a lot during like the draft was that don't draft a running back high, because Todd Gurley, like Paul said, I'd say him and Ezekiel Elliott were like the top two running backs in the league comfortably for a couple of years. I mean, Jared Goff was the quarterback, but Todd Gurley was carrying that offense pretty good. Him and those receivers, I mean, they were the offense there. So just to see him in a couple years later, it would be cool to see him in the Honolulu Blue. Just to come on in, I don't know, just, you're never going to show necessarily the kind of season you did a couple years back, but come in and have a comfortably good season, kind of like Adrian Peterson did last year, or maybe even a little better, where he comes in, AP's kind of, you know, I don't want to say washed up because that's disrespectful to a really impressive career, but he's not quite what he once was. But he comes in and has a comfortably good season and like provides some good depth, a good veteran presence that other players like. Are we going to remember AP's time as a Lion? Probably not in like 4 or 5 years. But I think it's fun, and I think that's the sort of thing we get from Todd Gurley. Like a running back, a younger veteran, so to speak.
But a guy that's already accomplished.
But a guy that is already shown... Yeah, that's a good way to put it. He's comfortably been like one of the best in the league. And I think that's like the great kind of presence to have when you have, especially with the running backs they have. Like DeAndre Swift getting guided by Todd Gurley just sounds awesome. Does that not just sound awesome?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I love that. So, yeah. Anything you wanted to add, Paul? You looked mysterious here.
Yeah. And the big thing between like Todd Gurley and Adrian Peterson, the Lions know that they weren't going to get prime Adrian Peterson. They were 100% certain of that. You're not 100% certain that, you know, that Todd Gurley's probably best two seasons are behind him, but you could get some very good ball out of Todd Gurley, like top 10 running back. It's probably not going to happen, but the potential's still there. So it's kind of disappointing that they are likely not going to get him.
All right, is that all for Lions then?
Yeah, that's all I got.
All right, let's move on to the Red Wings now. So the Red Wings, it's the off season, not too much crazy going on, but we are approaching the draft, and the draft odds were finally announced for your Detroit Red Wings. And then they were pulled, and for the first time in the draft lottery history, Your Detroit Red Wings stayed put. They didn't, you know, they didn't move up, but that's, I think for Detroit fans, that might be asking that much. They stayed put at number six. So the Red Wings will be picking six for the third time in 4 years. It's happening again, folks. This time not at the expense of falling five spots. So, I mean, thank God for that. That was just the worst last year. But they didn't fall in one of the weirdest drafts in history. Like, this is going to be such a weird draft. Like, I've already started my deep dive into, like, kind of what the prospects are. And I'm sure I'll probably talk about this, like, next week or the week after when it's the eve of the draft. But I've already fallen in love with a couple of prospects. But even then, it's, like, it's hard to say because there's not as much tape for a lot of teams this year, a lot of players. You have guys like, Dylan Gunther. Dylan Gunther, he played in the WHL, who had their season canceled postponed, and they ended up playing like 2 months, shortened season, in your own division. And he put up some crazy numbers, but just in his own crappy division. So it's kind of hard to get a true read on these numbers. And then you have like U of M with Kent Johnson, some of their elite prospects, and they're kind of, you know, they looked great, but they also had limited seasons with limited opponents. So it's going to be such a weird year, and this is the 1 year I didn't really care where the Red Wings fell, because I think they're going to get their, I think they're going to get a guy no matter what. Like, they have a couple, like, number one, I'd say the consensus is Owen Powers right now, but I don't think that's because he's necessarily an elite talent. I think that has more to do with the fact that he's the safest bet, and I think that kind of brings me into what I want to talk about the Red Wings most today, is, like, I don't want Steve Yzerman to play it safe this time. Like, I don't think he really has yet. Like, with Moritz Seider, was projected as, like, as low as the 20s in that draft in 2019 that he picked him up. And he was just crowned the best defenseman in the world tournaments. I mean, just last week. Like, he was insane against grown adults. And he obviously had probably the best defenseman of season, or a defenseman that young has ever had in the SHL. And he took kind of a swing there. And with the Capitals pick kind of rounding out the first round, I think he needs to take just a big swing this time. At this point in the rebuild, I don't think Steve Yzerman can keep playing it safe. I don't think you can go with a Joe Valeno. I don't think you can go with, like, I don't know, someone who will probably be good in the NHL. Like, has a pretty low floor. Like, if they bust, it won't be by much. They'll be like a fourth line center, you know. They will be NHL players. It's just how good will they be? I think he needs to go with someone with a low floor and a high ceiling. The two that come to mind for me are William Eklund and Kent Johnson. Both, to me, are the most skilled in the draft. And both could very well be there at that sixth spot. I think I'd prefer Eklund at this point. It may be because he's Swedish. I love the Swedes. But I think he needs to draft for skill. You can't just draft for safety at this point. In this point in the rebuild, we need to take a massive swing for talent. It should not be Simone Edvinson or one of those defensemen that are projected in the top 10 in the draft who are just going to be good. I want someone elite. I want someone who turns into Lucas Raymond, who turns into one of the Philip Zadina.
Now, with the draft, is there one thing that we could consider as a possibility that I love? But obviously, probably not the best idea this time around. Trading down.
Oh, I got nervous. I thought you were going to go towards the goaltender route, because that's another one I should probably talk about too. But first, to answer your question, trading down is not a terrible idea, especially in this year's draft. Specifically, if you're pursuing a goaltender, it's not a bad idea to trade down. The problem is that kind of falls opposite to the philosophy I want him to chase, because I want him to take a risk. And that is the definition of not taking a risk, is kind of trading back and just ensuring that you have a little bit more comfort. So I would personally disagree with the take, I guess. I don't think they should. They already have 12 picks in this draft. I mean, they already have so many picks. I don't think you need to add a couple more, like, fourth rounders. There are seven rounds, well. Yeah. I believe seven rounds. Let me pull it up. How many? I think it's the same. But I think the only problem I have with that scenario, with trading back, is that it just kind of, the organization stays the same. But if you want to take the best goaltender prospect we've had since Carey Price, then you trade back and draft a goalie if he's still there. Jesper Wallstedt. So he played in the same league as Moritz Seider did this year over in the Swedish Hockey League, Jesper Wallstedt. And he put up insane save percentages with grown men at 18. He is 18 this year, and he has looked like one of the best goaltenders since Carey Price. Like, since his draft came out, like, even better than Spencer Knight a couple years back. He's already proven himself, like, in the playoffs. So this guy is coming out here and looking this good. The thing is, drafting a goaltender in the top 10, it kind of makes me nervous. Jonathan Bernier this year, who has been amazing, was drafted like in the top 10 by the Kings and was there for like a couple years and just bounced around. He was with the Maple Leafs a couple years back. And I think you can find serviceable goaltenders or even above average goaltenders in free agency. Like Thomas Greiss even, he ended with like a .911 save percentage after having a rough start to the season. But he's a serviceable one that we just picked up in free agency for like $3.6 million. So I think, if you're going to trade back and take a goaltender, I think that's just too safe. And I don't know. I always go back to the philosophy. I think this year is pretty important. It doesn't have quite like the Pistons, Cade Cunningham type, or even the Shane Wright that 2022 draft has. But I think, just take a swing, Steve. Like, you have another first rounder. Maybe you even get maybe Sebastian Kosa, who's like the next best goalie prospect, I guess. Maybe they take him later. I don't know. I just don't love the idea of trading down. But I think that's really it with the Red Wings right now. I think their main thing is number 6 in the draft. I'm going to be watching way too much tape of prospects I'll never even think about after the Red Wings don't draft them. And I'm going to inevitably fall in love with a couple that Steve Yzerman either doesn't draft or gets taken by someone else, because that's just how drafts go. Like, it's very rare we have like a Lions draft this year where the prospect most of us fell in love with was just picked. Like, that was pretty sick. But let's go into the roundtable. We talked about all the teams. I've been pretty excited for this roundtable. Ryan has it prepared for us. I like it when Ryan prepares a roundtable, because it's usually, it reminds me of like a radio host, how he's kind of, I don't know, you get a good segment out of it. I like it.
Well, thank you. So for our roundtable today, I prepared some over-unders for player stats. So our predictions for these over-unders for this upcoming season. And I just came up with all of these kind of off the top of my head. Like, I didn't find them from, you know, Vegas or anything. So these are just, you know, your predictions. Do you think these will happen? So let's just get right into it. So for Jared Goff, first one, do you think he'll have plus or minus 4,000 passing yards? And let's throw it to Paul first. Paul, what do you think? Plus or minus 4,000, over under?
I think 5,000 is out of the question. It's not going to happen. 4,500 is even a bit of a stretch. I think 3,000 is almost a guarantee. I think it's going to be fairly close. I see him around the 4,200-yard mark, so I'm going to say over, but it's going to be... Well, I forget they have a 17th game. I'm going to throw in about 4,500 then.
Yeah, I forgot about the 17th game, too. I think that might just put it over for me, like just over. I think he's going to be hovering. I think that's right where it should be, honestly, because, like, With the offensive line that they have this year, like, logically, I want to take the under, because I think they're going to be focused on the running game. That's what Jared Goff has been comfortable with historically, is focusing on the running game and using play action to his advantage. So if I had to bet, honestly, now I'm thinking about it, I don't know. The safe bet is over, I know it is, but my gut is telling me under. I think he's going to get like 3,800, 3,900. I think he's going to be just a little short. I think he's going to have a couple games where he only has like 160 yards. Like, I think there's going to be a couple of games where he gets, you know, where he doesn't have much. So I'm going to go under. What do you think, Ryan?
So actually, just really quickly for reference. So Jared Goff, in his career, he's had 4 seasons that he's been the full-time starter. And he's had 2 seasons of 4,600 plus, and 2 seasons of close to 4,000. So like 3,800, 3,900.
Okay, so that is a close range then.
Yeah. All so right. So I kind of tried to do it based on what some of these guys have done in the past, and like what would be reasonable yet like a decent goal to like, you know, work towards, I guess, for Jared. So with that being said, I'm also going to take the over. I do think that 17th game is...
Yeah, I can't really argue. Like I said, I'm going to pull a Paul here, and I'm going to say it's my gut. I feel like the way they're going to use him this year is going to be just project him into, like, 3,900. Like, it's going to be so close.
Yeah, and you know, I do agree that I think they're going to focus more heavily on the run game. But I think that the way the Rams offenses have been, like, just sculpted kind of in the past, and I know they're not, it's obviously not going to be exactly the same, but a lot of it is passes created by that running game. So, you know, and it's a passing league still. You're going to see a lot of passes.
You are
like
still
that's
see
just
passes, yeah.
that's the state of the
like, no matter what Dan Campbell says, he's not going to come in here and just like, he's not going to just be like, all right, we're running Army's offense now. Triple option, baby. Like, he's right. Going to have, yeah, he's going to focus on the passing. Yes. All right.
All right, let's go to the next one. We'll try to make them a little bit quicker than that one.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
I got a decent amount here, but we also don't have to go through all of them. Okay, so the next one for Jared Goff, over under 19.5 touchdowns. So do you think he'll hit that 20 mark?
Do you want to take this one, Paul? Do you have an idea? All right.
I think 30 would be a more reasonable number. I think 20 for 17 game season, there should be no reason he doesn't hit 20 unless the Lions go like 0-17.
So he's only had one career in his or one season in his career that he's hit the 30 mark. And he's hit the 20 mark every year since being a starter.
Yeah, and with a 17th game in there, you can basically add another touchdown. I think that's fair. I see him around 30. I don't see under 20.
Yeah, I'd say over. I think he's probably going to get like 25, 24, 25, 26, 12, like just at mid-20s, I guess is the easiest way to say it. I just see him in the mid-20s. What about you, Ryan?
Yeah, I think I'm going to take the over for this one too, just because... you know, because of that extra game, obviously you have to consider that, and just history says that he will hit that 20 mark. So yeah, I think I'm going to take the over on that one. All right. So our next one, we have DeAndre Swift.
Ooh.
So
the backs,
over under 1200 yards from scrimmage. So that's, you know, rushing and passing.
All right. So 1200 yards, that would be an average of 70 yards a game.
But that's both rushing and passing.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to go over. I'm going to go over then. Because 70, if it was yards, I'd go under. But he is also a back that can receive, too.
Mm-hmm.
And if I think he's going to take the step he takes, I think over. I think actually comfortably over, I'll go.
For me, this is hard because I don't actually think DeAndre Swift's going to be RB1 later in the season. I know I'm going to... very small minority here, but I'm going to pretend that he is going to be RB1. And in this scenario, I see about 1,150 scrimmage yards.
I like how specific you are, Paul.
Yeah, I'm going to take the over too. I just think that all signs point to the fact that they really are just going to kind of feature him as one of the main.
Of the
him and Hockenson, I think, are just going to be kind of the ones that are maybe leaned on a little bit for some of this offense, because, you know, where else is it going to come from? So, yep, I'm going to take the over on that one. All right. And then DeAndre Swift, over under 9.5 total touchdowns. So do you think he's going to get 10 total?
Oh, God, that's right on the edge there.
I want to see what Paul thinks.
I think he gets 9 touchdowns, exactly. And if they do what they did last year and hand it off to Adrian Peterson a lot at the goal line, I know they don't have Adrian Peterson, but if they go to like a Jamal Williams or whoever's their RB3, or they hand it off to Jared Goff, that's what I think is going to happen a lot. I don't think DeAndre Swift's going to get a lot of goal line rushes. Is this rushing touchdowns or total?
Total touchdowns.
Total?
Yep, so rushing and receiving.
I think he might have a couple receiving touchdowns, but it's going to be tough. It's going to be close. I'm going to go with 9 exactly.
I'm going to go under here. I think the most important point, I mean, obviously it's a different coaching staff, but like you said, like kind of the way AP was treated, I see DeAndre Swift as like as the back who gets you like good yardage on first and second downs and like gives you third and manageable, gives you those situations. I don't necessarily see him as a guy you bring out like when it's third and one or what. Like I'm thinking that's what more like Jamal Williams or even Jamar Jefferson or if Todd Gurley gets signed. Todd Gurley in the red zone's fun. Like even injured Todd Gurley in the red zone is good. Like so if Todd, especially Todd Gurley, that's like a well under, I think.
Yeah, so I kind of struggled with this one. I think I'm going to take the under as well because I do think that they're going to have some more specialized guys for red zone situations. But I think DeAndre Swift is going to be close because of the usage I'm projecting kind of for him. I do believe that he's going to be a main focus like we were talking about. So I'm going to take the under, but it would not surprise me if he gets 10 plus total touchdowns. All right, so next one we have, just speaking of him, Jamal Williams. So, over under 1,100 yards from scrimmage.
That's a tough one.
So
I'm going under.
Okay, and you took the over for Swift for yards from scrimmage, right? Okay.
Yep, so I think Swift will end up with more yards than him.
I'm going to go with over. However, if he is the RB2 for most of the season, it's going to be well under. I will acknowledge that. But I do think he will overtake DeAndre Swift this season for RB1. And we'll have about 1,400 total. I did give DeAndre 1,150. But I don't think DeAndre gets to 1150 if Jamal is at 1400. Likewise, if DeAndre Swift is the RB1, there's no way Jamal Williams is getting the 1400. But I will go if Jamal Williams is the RB1 getting to that about 1400 range.
And I put these for DeAndre Swift and Jamal Williams, I put them at so similar kind of on purpose to like kind of proceeding with the thought that like if you take the over for one, you're probably going to take the under for one. So I was kind of curious where you guys stood on that.
Yeah, no. Yeah, for sure. I think DeAndre Swift is certainly RB1 comfortably. The only thing I adjust for, like, I think is touchdowns. I think that's the hardest to predict with I don't know, goal line situations are always so weird. But I think at the end of the year, once we take a look back, I think DeAndre Swift is going to comfortably lead Jamal Williams in yards.
Right. And so my answer, I would probably also take the under because I took the over with DeAndre Swift. And I think, you know, absolutely. We've seen crazy 1-2 punches in the NFL, but no matter how you slice it, the amount of work that DeAndre Swift is going to get is going to come to some extent at the expense of Jamal Williams.
Yep.
All right. So then, continuing with Jamal Williams, over under 7.5 total touchdowns.
7.5. You know what?
Do you want me to take this one really quickly?
Yeah, go ahead first, because I'm thinking, I'm like...
I'm actually going to take the over here, because I could see a situation where just, you know, Jamal Williams kind of ends up just eating up a lot of the touchdown production, just whether it's situational, like goal line situations or even just, you know, just kind of, I don't want to say by fluke, but just that's kind of just the way
their role
on
the team,
the way the cards played or whatever. So I'm going to take the over just kind of a little bit as just like a, you know, hey, I think this might happen. Just
yeah,
for, it's like not necessarily, I don't have like a a strict kind of basis
for this. It more represents your belief about, like, an aspect of the season.
Just a storyline that could arise, I guess.
I think... I'm going to be annoying here. I'm going to put a caveat in. So, I will say he gets the over with this current running back room. If Todd Gurley comes in, I will switch it to under. With this current room, I don't really see Jamar Jefferson yet. Like, obviously, we haven't seen enough from him. But I don't think he comes in here and eats enough. And based on my projection earlier, I'm gonna go with it. Yeah, I'm going to say he gets under. Or over currently. As we said, Jamal Williams gets over.
Well, if we throw Todd Gurley into these running back discussions, I just think Todd Gurley's RB1, and it completely shakes the room.
Paul, I promise you that would not happen. I mean, right now Todd Gurley is looking for a prove-it deal. He's trying to show that he still belongs in the NFL. And we have a... Well, okay, but he's had a very down year. You're not picking him up just and playing him just because of his name, you know? You have to look at production, and this coaching staff clearly believes in DeAndre Swift, and they signed Jamal Williams for a reason. There's a reason that they went after these guys, and Todd Gurley still hasn't been signed by a team, you know? It's unlikely that you're going to sign a running back this late for him to lead that running back room.
But also, I don't think they're going to get Todd Gurley, so I'm going to go based off of that. I think it's going to be over. And it's going to be a weird prediction. I don't like to predict it like this. DeAndre Swift's going to miss a game or two. That's just how it's going to happen. He's not going to have a major injury or anything. He's just going to have like a sore ankle or something. One of these running back injuries that keep you out of the game. It seems like every running back misses a game or two every year. Like without flaw. And Jamal Williams, when he was doing that with Aaron Jones, could do it. Giovanni Bernard's another one. He's always behind Joe Mixon, and then when he gets in, he does very well and puts up near Mixon numbers, but you can see there's a big difference between RB1 and RB2.
Kawhi Leonard just called. He says it's load management talking, because I think that's what it is with running backs. I think a lot of them, it's like, it's based on genuine injuries, like, but I think it's more like a rest thing. Like, if it was a playoff game, they would not sit through it. I think that's more the thing. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think Jamal gets the over here. Like, I don't know. I just somehow think he gets it.
All right, so we're all in agreement with that one. So let's move on to a fan favorite here, TJ Hockenson.
Ooh.
All right, so over under 850 receiving yards.
Oh, that's a bit much for a task of a tight end. Let me think. Let me look at what the average per game that is. So 850 divided by 17. That means he's got to get 50 yards a game as a tight end. I'm going to go under. I hate to say it, but I think this year he's going to find himself a bit more as a run-blocking tight end. Because we drafted him to where that's like an important part of it, and I think he's going to mesh well with this offensive line. And with my I don't know. Because you'd think with the style of game that Goff plays and with a kind of offense they'd run, that tight ends would probably be relatively active. But if you look at it, tight ends don't thrive as much under Jared Goff as the receivers do. So I'm going to go under just because receivers typically, I don't know. It seems like Jared Goff gets along with his receivers well. And I also, with the caveat of saying, I love TJ Hockenson, and I think he's amazing. Like, I love TJ Hockenson. I just think he gets the under this year. I don't know. I just think I don't know if it shakes out for him this year.
I'm going to go with the over, and it's not that I think Jared Goff is going to put up absurd numbers, even though I do have him over 4,000 passing yards. I look at TJ Hockenson to be Jared Goff's wide receiver one. I know he's playing tight end, but look at the Lions receiving corps. It's one of the worst in the entire NFL, and they have TJ Hockenson playing tight end. Why wouldn't they be throwing the ball to him? 50 yards a game, I think that's fairly easy. I see him near 65, 70 yards a game. He could get to 1,000. I think he can get to 1,000. It's going to be very close. But if he is the Lions' kind of wide receiver one, like tight ends can be, he'll probably get to 1,000 yards.
And Paul, I'm actually going to completely agree with you. The only thing I'm going to say, I don't know if he'll have 65, 70, because 1,100 yards is a lot for a tight end. And, I mean, I think I'm a big believer of TJ Hockenson. I think he's still going to continue to take leaps in his game. And I think that he really is going to kind of act as, like, a security blanket for Jared Goff. A guy who, you know, they'll throw, like, a lot of, like, over-the-middle type passes with the play actions. And I think that TJ Hockenson is just a good archetype for just an over-the-middle, you know, possession, get some big guy yards, you know. And I think, I really believe that he could be a featured part of this offense enough to where he could be, I mean, I could even see him leading the team in receiving yards. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen, but I do believe that that is in the realm of possibility.
I see him leading the team in receiving yards and receiving touchdowns and total touchdowns, not named Jared Goff. Because I think he's going to end up getting more touchdowns than either of the running backs. He's a better receiver than the receiving core. And folks, draft this guy in fantasy this year. Like, if he's still available in the late fourth round, this is a guy you want. He's going to be the Lions wide receiver one. He is going to be their top target. He's going to be a target in the end zone.
I don't disagree that he's their number one receiver. I think I'm basing mine off of historical basis and how tight ends are used in the NFL. Historically, Jared Goff doesn't throw to his receivers as much, and his tight end as much. And historically, tight ends, that's kind of a tough thing to reach for. But I get what you guys are saying, because I do think he is the best receiving weapon. I think he is probably the best offensive weapon. He's maybe not the best offensive player, because that might be our center there. But I think in terms of weapons, he's definitely... I think that's a good way to put him, Ryan, is that he's a safety blanket. And that's why I don't know if he gets quite... I think we're going to see a lot of chucking down to Hawk when it gets dangerous and getting like 6-7 yards, like him blitzing forward for that, but not, you know, not anything crazy. But I'm going to go under. But it's a respectful under.
Okay. And so really quickly, I think what I'm going to do is I think I'm going to break this up into two parts. So next episode we'll do the defensive players.
Oh,
and we'll
good
just
idea,
finish
good
out
idea.
The offensive players right now, because we'll be recording for a long time if we go through every one of these players. All right. And then for Hockenson, over under 5.5 touchdowns.
I'll go over. I think he's going to be a red zone target. And I think that's another reason he doesn't necessarily rack up yardage. I think he's going to be brought out in those like second and goals where you just try to run it up the middle. It just didn't work. So you're going to bring in him out and just like slant him or had him cut to the left, you know, something like that. I think he's actually going to have a good amount. I like when you first said that he's going to beat the running backs in terms of total touchdowns, I thought that was kind of ridiculous, but thinking about it more, I think that's plausible. I don't think it'll happen, but I do think he will be their most dangerous red zone weapon, because Jamal Williams and DeAndre Swift both aren't like, I don't know, a touchdown magnets, and I think like TJ Hockenson could be the team's touchdown magnet, so I'm gonna go over.
No, I think he will have the most touchdowns on the team. I think he'll be in the double digits. I think he'll be about 12, which isn't that unreasonable, if we're being honest. Because if I give Jared Goff about, say, I'm giving him 30 touchdown passes. So 12 receptions by Hockenson, who's getting the other 18? Probably just your wide receiver one, wide receiver two, getting about 7 of each, and then your running backs are getting about 4. That seems about right.
I was just going to say really quickly, I would imagine it's going to be a little more spread out than that as far as the share of touchdowns.
Bit.
But I can see where you're coming from.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's as ridiculous as it may sound at first.
Now, I am actually going to go against the grain a little bit here. I'm going to take the under.
Okay.
I'm going to say that, I don't know, I guess this one's kind of more as a kind of a gut thing, but, you know, I could see him with... in a situation where he does kind of rack up a lot of those yards just between the 20s. But, you know, there could be situations where he just doesn't end up in the end zone necessarily. Like, he's still contributing in the passing game. But I'm just going to, just kind of as a gut feeling, I'm going to say maybe he hits 5. You know, maybe he is, like, I guess maybe a little higher than middle of the pack as far as touchdown production, but not like the number one, like holding it down at the top. So I'll take the under for that one. All right. So next up, we have expected wide receiver one, Tyrell Williams. Now, do you think he'll be over or under 1,000 receiving yards?
Under.
I think under, but barely. This is also going with the fact that he is supposedly the wide receiver one, which I think is fair. I think Tyrell Williams is a fair wide receiver one. He's capable of it for the Lions franchise anyways. Not for most franchises, but for this one. But I do think Hockenson will be the main target.
Just for a little bit of reference, Williams has 1,000-plus yard receiving season. Receiving season in his career. And then the rest have been kind of hovering around the 600, 700 yard.
Yeah, I honestly don't see him too close to it because I think that other wide receivers are going to start making a push later on.
I would note that he wasn't a wide receiver one in those seasons, though. So
he was kind of supposed to be the wide receiver one in Oakland, but then I'm pretty sure he got hurt that year. But like that's what he was brought in for, at least in Oakland. So there was a time where he was kind of holding down that wide receiver one role. But you are right, he has spent most of his career as, you know, somebody to kind of like take the pressure off of the number one receiver. Like he spent a lot of time in that wide receiver two role, which I think he's still a very good NFL wide receiver two. So I'm interested to see if he can kind of make that jump into the wide receiver one territory. But so for my answer, I'm actually going to take the under. And the reason I'm doing that is because I took the over with Hockenson. And I don't know. I don't know if I don't know how many guys will have necessarily like hovering around that 1,000-yard mark where we might have some just more spread out yardage kind of just in smaller quantities throughout the roster. So I could see him around like the maybe 800 to 900 yard mark. That's kind of where my expectations are right now, or just kind of what I think.
I think 700 to 800 is pretty comfortable for me. I'm pretty comfortable with that.
Okay, and then still talking about Tyrell Williams, over or under 3.5 touchdowns.
Under. I'm going to go under.
Under?
Yeah, because I don't have Goff at many touchdowns this year. I'm going to go with under here. I don't think he gets that many this year. I think maybe he grabs a couple. I think 3's fair. I think this is fair for him to get more touchdowns. I think he is a player that has, like when I say he gets under 3 touchdowns, or 3 touchdowns or less, that may sound like I'm saying he's not the caliber of receiver he is. I just think that's more of a reflection of how the team is going to be built this year.
Like I said earlier, I got Goff throwing 30 touchdowns, so he's going to have to throw somebody. So I got him getting 4 on the dot, which add that to Hockenson's 12 and like a Swift 3 and a Williams 1. Like it's either 20. The other receivers will pick up the slack.
Yeah, actually, Paul, I'm going to agree with you again. I think he's going to hit right around that 4 to 5 mark. So I'm going to take the over, but just barely over. I could very well see a situation where he gets a decent amount of yards, but literally has like 2 or 3 touchdowns. Like that's very possible, I certainly think. But I'm going to take the over. I feel fairly confident that he'll be able to pull in, you know, a touchdown every third game-ish. Or yeah, whatever. So yeah, I'm going to take the over. Okay, so we all went there, right?
Yes.
Okay, sweet. All right, our next one is going to be expected wide receiver 2, Breshad Perriman. So over or under 700 receiving yards? Paul, do you have any thoughts?
I think he'll be under 1,000 for sure. I think he just has to go over 700 if I'm having Tyrell Williams under 1,000. because there's no way Hawkinson is going to put up like 2,000 receiving yards. It's just not going to happen as much as I'd like it.
There are other receivers on the roster too that they'll be will be thrown to, of course.
Yeah, but how often do your wide receiver 3 and wide receiver 4s have like 1,000 receiving yards?
Well, you also have your, you know, your slot receiver, your tight end too. Other running backs, they're mouths to feed for sure.
Yeah, but they don't get fed more than 30 yards a game. They're kind of just there. No, I see the wide receiver 2 being around the 750 yard mark. I think that's pretty fair. So over, but barely. It's not going to be by a lot. It's going to be final game.
Okay, yeah. I think I'm going to take the under. I think he's going to be closer to that 600 mark because I think he's going to be used as kind of like a Marvin Hall type receiver, but just a little more involved because he will be wide receiver too, but he's never really put together a consistent like over the middle or possession type game kind of. He's always kind of been like the guy to, you know, break the top off of the defense and like kind of like dart down the field. Like he's been always a deep threat. So it'll be interesting to see. I think if he's not able to kind of round out his game enough to be like a true wide receiver too, then I'll take the under on that one.
I don't know with this one. 700, that is a good place to put it too, because I think he's going to hover right around there. I'm going to go just under because I'm a pessimist. I like being a pessimist. I'm going to go just under.
Okay, and then for touchdowns, I have it set as the same as Tyrell Williams. 3.5 touchdowns.
Under.
I agree. He's going to get under. It's going to be 2 touchdowns.
Now, this one I'm going to actually take the over. And the reason I say this is because, like I just said, he is that, like, deep threat, you know? I could see a situation where, like, 4 times this season he ends up, you know, getting the big play. He's kind of that big play threat, so I don't think it's unrealistic for him to find 4 situations in which he was able to kind of expose the defense, because that is the type of receiver he is. All right, so next up, for our last offensive player, we have rookie Amon-Ra St. Brown.
Yes, that's what I was waiting for. Yes, sir.
We'll see if Paul can pronounce the name correctly. Paul, you're going to have to try at least once, okay? So, are you going to try right now?
Well, I need to hear your under and over first.
Okay, fine. Okay, so I have his over-under for receiving yards set at 650.
He's going, yeah, Amon-Ra St. Brown's going to hit 825 yards exactly receiving. And I'll just give you my touchdowns right now. He's going to get 5.
I'm going over here. I think Amon-Ra steps in and is a savage. I think he is going to be one of the best receivers on the team. I think he's 1 or 2. I love him. I love his tape. I think he's going to come here and show his versatility with the team. And I think he's actually going to find more comfort with Amon-Ra than even some of the better receivers on the team. Maybe even better than Hawkinson. I know that's hot. I don't think he's better than Hawkinson. But I could see him, and I just want to see him come in there and show that versatility and get good with Jared Goff. I would love to see that.
And I have to think that our takes right now are terribly biased. But I am going to take the over. I believe in Amon-Ra St. Brown.
I love him so much.
And, you know, that was actually one of the guys I was most excited about. And that was kind of a pick that I was like, at that selection, I was like, okay, this is one of the guys that I would really like to see here. And then just to kind of see his name called, you know, that just, I'm very excited about this guy. And I think he's going to come right in and start in the slot. And I think the slot's going to be pretty important for this offense. Yep. Because like we talked about, there's a good chance we'll see a lot of kind of over the middle crossing type
play action. And that's, yeah. And Goff has always loved his slot receivers. So I think that's part of my bias here I'm putting into the equation, I guess, like how much he likes his slot receivers.
And I believe I threw this comparison out earlier or in one of our earlier episodes, but my favorite comparison potential comparison for him is Robert Woods.
Yes, I think 100%.
You know, we've seen what Jared Goff was able to do with a guy that he similar to Hockenson, kind of that safety blanket, kind of a guy that will, you can check it down to, you can get like chunk yards, maybe not like, you know, he might not be streaking down the field all the time, but I think he'll be definitely just a trusted weapon kind of in Jared Goff's bag that he can reach for, yeah. I guess.
Now, he won't be at Robert Woods' level.
Right, I don't think he will in his rookie year.
He can get at least 15 yards a game on the jet sweep.
Okay. That's how you know you're an elite slot receiver. All right, so what's your over-under for touchdowns with him?
All right, so his over-under for touchdowns, I have it set at 2.5.
Over. Over. Well, I get, okay, he's a slot receiver. Nope, screw it, over. I'm going over. I love Amon-Ra St. Brown.
I already said 5.
Join the hype train.
I struggle with this one.
Join the hype.
But yeah, I'm going to take the over because... I don't know. It's just not fun to take the under.
No,
so
no.
This one, I think we did a pretty good job answering the other ones, like, you know, truthfully and honestly. I'm okay to hop on this Amon-Ra St. Brown hype train right now.
I hope he comes in there. SL1, slot 1, bro. Oh, I'm so excited for him.
All right, so that's what I got for over-under for the offense. So next week we'll touch on the defense. And I'm excited about this one, too. This one should be – because, you know, we got a lot of young guys on defense.
And defensive young statistics that, are hard to pin down, too. Those
right,
are good
ones.
I'm literally going to have to look up average statistics on the defense because I literally have no clue. I've been watching this game for years. I couldn't tell you average sacks, average tackles, average tackle for losses. I can tell you what's kind of good for a game, or kind of the range, but I'm going to have to do some research.
Well, I'm excited to find ourselves in a situation where Paul has done his due diligence. That should be exciting.
It's always fun when Paul comes in here, because, like, I mean, we all do this sometimes, but he just comes in a lot of times just kind of vibing. And it's always fun when he comes
to Paul's
and,
credit, he always fires off the
well, I was just about to say
when, statistics. He has that on
yes,
lock.
When he comes in with a Tiger statistics, I know I can rely on Paul for most of them. Like, that is the one thing he's like, all right, I'll do this. So I'm excited to hear, like, because you're good with remembering numbers, too. You will genuinely come in and remember probably the average tackles for a loss by an NFL defenseman. I know it's going to happen.
I can't wait.
All right, well, I think that wraps up everything. Talked some lotto, talked for both teams, talked all that sort of stuff, talked draft. Next week, like Ryan said, we'll keep up with this roundtable, but we're going the D side. And I'll probably dive more into some Red Wings picks, and I'm sure the Tigers will find another way to just break our spirits. And also, before I go, let's plug our Twitters. First, the most important, you got to follow the Motown Megacast. That's at MMegacast on Twitter. Find fantastic stuff. Tell all of your friends. All right. And then my at on Twitter is Alex Pick Faber. I love it. Paul, what's yours?
At Paul_Cassell. That's KISELL.
I'm disappointed it's not at Real Paul the Wall, but, you know, I guess we can't all be happy.
All right. And my Twitter is just... It's I believe it's at Ryan Caloris.
I'm pretty sure it's something like I looked at it the other day. I'm like, oh, he got like one of the
yep. It's just at Ryan Caloris. So RYANCOLORES.
I was gonna say colors. It's colors, not Calores. Colors.
Caloris.
Yes, yeah. Beautiful. All right, thanks for listening, guys.